You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Rosie Perez has appeared in many hit films like Do the Right Thing, White Men Can't Jump, and Fearless, which earned her an Oscar nomination. But she has written a memoir which reveals that her own life story is stranger than any of the films she has starred in. The book, Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair, is just out from Crown, and I'm very pleased it has brought Rosie Perez back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Now, you and I have talked many times, but you've only barely alluded to the past in the story of this very difficult childhood that you tell in this book. Is it something that you didn't want to talk about before, or perhaps it even blocked from your memory?
It was definitely not blocked. A few instances were blocked, but I didn't want to tell it because, one, I wasn't emotionally ready to tell it, and two, I clearly understood the possible response from the entertainment world and from media, and I really just wanted a fair shot in the room because I had to contend with that my entire life. And now that I was an adult, I just wanted to live. And I knew that it would come into play, and I knew I would be limited, and I refused that. And so, you know, that was a big part of it. But honestly, Leonard, I haven't said this yet. It really was just too painful.
Mm-hmm. But now you've decided to do it?
Yes, I decided to do it. Actually, I didn't want to do it. I was kind of talked into doing it. People always wanted me to write a book, and I would say no, no, no. And they had no clue about the home, about the abuse, about my mother's mental illness. They had this fantasy of me doing hip-hop down the streets of Bushwick, which was so insulting and ridiculous. But... you know, I worked on myself. I went to therapy constantly because I just didn't want to live with the pain anymore. I wanted to get past my past.
Well, how did you pass it together? Because some of it is from when you were a baby or a toddler. You must have interviewed family members.
I guess I did. It was more of a conversation, like my cousin Millie, I turned to a great deal. She's the eldest cousin, and so she was like, oh yes, this hopping and that hopping, and also my sister Carmen. Also this one girl that was in the home and in the group home with me. We're still in contact to this day, and I talked to her throughout. And just to say to her, did this really happen as intensely as I remember it? And she goes, no. I go, oh. She goes, it was worse. And I was like, okay, great. Let me start typing. Let me call my therapist now. And so, that's how I got a lot of help in that regard. But I did remember a lot.
You begin with your birth and the fact that your parents were married, but not to each other.
Right.
How had they met, and what were the circumstances of their relationship when you were born? Were they living together?
I don't want to give too much away, but it was very...
Well, I'm going to talk about the story, Rosie.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, it was scandalous. My mother went to go see who her sister was going to go on a date with, even though everyone knew he was a married man. And when she looked out the window and saw my father-to-be, she excused herself by saying, I'm going to go take out the garbage. I'll be right back. And she ran down the staircase and then went into a slow strut. And my father was walking up the staircase, and he told me, he said, my heart just stopped when I saw her beauty. He asked her for a cup of coffee. They went, and the rest is history.
But your mother was Lydia, was a difficult person, and he eventually left, didn't he?
Yes.
And a week after you were born, you write that Lydia, your mother, brought you to your father's sister's house in Brooklyn and said she was going to... Your mother did this all the time. She said, I'm going out to the bodega for a minute. And she didn't come back for 3 years?
Yes. I'll be right back, you know.
She just dumped you on your
aunt? Here's the baby. I'll be right back. And 3 years later, she comes to get me, only to place me in a convent run by nuns that took care of children that were either unwanted, abandoned, or orphaned.
Well, you were with your aunt for 3 years. Did you think she was your mother?
I did believe that she was my mother.
And her children were your siblings?
And yes, my cousin Millie and Lude and Titi, I thought, and cousin Lorraine, I thought they were my sisters.
What about your father? Did you ever see him?
Yes, I saw him quite often, and I thought he was my uncle.
Uh-huh. So your mother came after you were 3 years old, as you said, took you from your aunt and brought you to St. Joseph's Catholic Home for Children. Where was that located?
That was upstate New York in Peekskill.
Did she ever explain to you why she took you from your aunt? Your aunt did not want her to take you.
No, not at all. My mother never fully explained. All she would say was, oh, I couldn't afford to take care of you, which probably explained why she put her other children in the home, but it didn't make any sense to me since I was being taken care of by my aunt and, unbeknownst to me, also by my father.
Well, you didn't know right away that you had half-siblings in the home. This was a pattern of your mother's, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How many kids did she have all
in
all? Nine?
Yeah.
And how many of them did she put in the home?
Nine.
Yeah. But she would keep them for a while as babies, and then at a certain point say, I can't afford to keep you anymore?
Yeah. I mean, and that was a result of her mental illness. You know, there was a lot of things that just didn't make sense.
My guest, in case you don't recognize that voice, is Rosie Perez. She has written a memoir called Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with great hair, and the picture on the cover of the book shows you with a lot of hair.
It's ridiculous, the amount of hair.
Now, we've heard horror stories about kids who are given up to some of these Catholic homes, but they all sound a little exaggerated. How bad was it at this place that you call the home?
There were bad moments, and there were nuns that treated you very badly, but there were also nuns that were really kind and gave me so much in regards to putting me on stage for the first time as a little girl. They would pick me out, and I would be on the front line in the Easter parade review, and tap dancing to the Candyman. When they would put on the Charlie Brown Christmas, I was always Lucy, but I wanted to be Linus, you know. And they kept telling me, "You have talent. You have talent," over and over and over. And you know, but also, there were nuns there that were so sweet and kind. When I would be placed on punishment, it was called restriction, and they would, you know, either spank me, beat me, or withhold food. And we would sneak down to the cafeteria, and there was a nun there, and she's in the picture in the book. When I went back, she goes, "I remember you. I used to sneak you cheese sandwiches because they used to starve you all the time." Oh, my goodness.
So she was one of the nice nuns, but then there was Sister Renata, who you put in your subtitle.
Yeah.
She seems to be just an awful person. Why do you think she was so angry?
I don't know. I don't know why she was angry. Maybe she just felt like she made a bad decision and now she was stuck, or I don't know, or maybe she, you know, spare the rod. Maybe she believed in that. I have no idea. But she was tough. She was tough. And here's the thing. Yes, she used to beat me all the time. She used to beat a lot of the kids all the time and give us these very cruel and harsh physical punishments.
She shoved soap in your mouth.
She would shove soap in my mouth, hit me till I bled. But at the same time, I kind of respected her and I held her in high regard because she was so in command. She was so in command.
But it's all you knew also. That is called child abuse.
Yes.
Would it have been called that at the time? Today, there would be serious lawsuits.
Yes, it would be serious lawsuits. And thank God there's new laws and great organizations like the Child's Rights Societies that, you know, advocate for kids in state care or in foster care. And, you know, I wish I had that, you know, but it wasn't around at the time.
One time you lost it and hit her back. What yes. happened then?
That was very painful for me to write, because remembering that she beat me until my body went limp. And I remember feeling the sheets and the sticking to the blood that was seeping out. And I was just left alone. And it was terrible. But I remember feeling pure hatred for her. And my response wasn't sad. It was bent on revenge. And so what I did was I ignored her and refused to speak to her. I think it was almost for like 2 full weeks. It drove her mad.
Mm.
And I know it sounds really cynical of me, but I had such delight in seeing her so upset.
How old were you at the time? I think that's a great strategy.
I think, right? I think I was about 7 or 8 years old.
Now, why did your mother have so many children? Did she have religious objections to birth control, or is she one of those people who loved having babies but then didn't know what to do with them once they were born?
I have no idea.
Well, did you see her often while you were at the home?
Yes, not often. She didn't come a lot, but I would see her. And there wasn't a lot of dialogue exchanged between us.
And then you say she was physically abusive as well.
Yes, she was very abusive.
And then on top of that, one of your half-brothers tried to molest you, and you told your mother. The reaction wasn't very motherly.
No. No, it wasn't.
She kind of blamed you.
Yes.
So what were you thinking? Were you aware of the way other kids' lives were?
I was, one, through television. I would escape through television a lot and just wish that I had that. And they had a volunteer program, which they call now Big Brother or Big Sister. And I had a wonderful volunteer. And she brought me to her house. And for the first time, it validated everything that I saw on television. I remember telling her, oh my goodness, you have a den like Darren in Bewitched. This is amazing. I love suburbia. Oh my goodness. What is this blanket? I've never had. It's a comforter. Oh my gosh, I want one when I get older. And so I got to see that. And also I went to what they called outside school.
Where kids who weren't in the home also attended.
Yes. And, you know, and we got to be around other kids that had parents in a home and that tucked them in at night and kissed them when they went off to school. And so I got to see that, you know, there is a possibility. There are good parents out there. There, you know, a kid could have a great life. And so I had a lot of hope in me.
Well, you describe your mother as being paranoid schizophrenic. Was she actually ever diagnosed as such and
yes.
treated? How old were you when you realized that she was mentally ill and that not everyone treated their children the way she treated hers?
I think that it was about when I was about 11 or 12. I asked the home's psychiatrist. I just said, is my mother crazy? Because that's what my half-siblings are telling me. Is it true? And he paused for a moment and he said, yes.
Now, the pictures in the book reveal that you were a beautiful child.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, I mean, you grew up to be a beautiful woman, but you were a beautiful child, and I would assume that there was a possibility of adoption or at least a foster home. Did that ever happen?
No. I used to fantasize about being adopted by a famous person. Where was Angelina Jolie when I was a kid? You know, I didn't like it when they would come to the home to pick out the kids. And I didn't like how the kids would rush up and play that game with them.
Like expectant puppies.
Yes. And, you know, in the window for sale. And it just bothered me so much. I was a peculiar kid. I understood exactly what was going on, and I did not want to participate. I refused. I felt that my soul, my integrity, my pride was being compromised each time they came to visit to take a pick of the litter, so to speak. And I hated it. And I would just stand off to the side. And I remember the nuns and the counselors was like, "You have a very bad attitude." And in my mind, I would say, "Yes, I do." But I wouldn't say anything, you know, back to them.
Rosie Perez is the Oscar-nominated actress. Her credits include Do the Right Thing, White Men Can't Jump, Fearless, The Counselor. She's also the artistic chair of Urban Arts Partnership and was on the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. And she has written a memoir called Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair. It is published by Crown. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And Rosie Perez has written a memoir called Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother, Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair. It's published by Crown, and it includes lots of pictures. And Rosie, I can see that you're a bit concerned that we're going to give away all of the good stories.
Yes, I am.
But you can reserve any ones that you want, because people buy these books. But also, you tell the story in your own voice in a way that is really, I hear you telling me this story when I read the book.
Oh, thank you. That was intentional because I wanted, one, to be honest, and two, I wanted to be authentic. And I didn't want to be pretentious in any kind of way in the writing. So I felt like I wanted the reader to feel like they came to my house and sat down with me over a glass of wine, and I just spilled it. That was my intention.
Well, you have called it an unpredictable life, but I would call it a self-invented life. Uh-huh. You, despite some of the things we've been talking about, and there are other stories that we could get into, although things started improving when you went into the children's home, a group home, didn't they? And then moved to L.A. But you really were starting off with kind of behind people who live typical lives, and you had to figure it all out for yourself.
Yes. You know, Leonard, I was figuring it out as a child. I felt like I was just doing time. And
in a prison, you mean?
Well, kind of, you know, but I just felt like, because also while I was in the home, in the group home, I did go stay with my aunt over the weekends and over the holidays and in Puerto Rico and what have you. You know, so I was just like, when they get this all settled and they get me out, I need to be ready for life because I want to live it to the fullest.
And then you did move in with your aunt.
Yeah.
And went to high school in Brooklyn?
Yes.
That's where the Bushwick thing comes in?
Yes.
When did you move to L.A.? And what took you out there?
I moved to L.A. because I loved Bushwick. I still love Bushwick. But there was also there was this huge element of danger constantly. And there was this limited thinking and this acceptance of limitations. And I felt like, wait a minute, I just went through such a horrific thing. I don't want to be part of this. I need to leave. I need to kind of branch out and go someplace else. And my cousin, Titi, God rest her soul, she sold me, all these things. Oh, L.A. is wonderful. You're going to love it. It's provides opportunity, just come out, help me with my kids, and, you know, I'll provide you with a safe place to live. And it was, I don't want to give away, but, you know, it was tough.
But I suspect that it's one of the reasons that you work with the Urban Arts Partnership, because you don't want other kids to feel limited?
Absolutely. You know, these kids, I get them. They walk into the schools and I could see the burden of life on their shoulders and I relate to it. And, you know, sometimes they act out in class. They're disrespectful to one another or to their teachers. And I get it. I understand that. But I also want them to know, and I do tell them this, when you become an adult, that's not acceptable. I'm sorry, the world does not care. And you need to deal with your past and need to deal with your issues so you can have a full, wonderful life.
Brooklyn has changed a lot since the days when you were growing up there. On Tuesday, Spike Lee, somebody you have worked with, spoke at length about why he thinks gentrification has hurt Fort Greene, where he grew up, and he's now moved to Manhattan. He's one of the few people who is moving in the other direction. But do you think gentrification is a bad thing for Bushwick, which is going through it right now?
Yes. I think it's good and bad. It's great that it's safer. It's great that it improved. But it's bad because a lot of the people that have been there from the beginning are not allowed to participate in all of that. They don't have the money to do so. And also, when they step out of their house now, they're judged constantly by the gentrifiers, the hipsters. I've seen hipsters move across the street if they see someone Puerto Rican or Dominican or black come down the street, and it's so sad. And you know, and also I read about Spike's rant, and you know, he's kind of right. He's kind of right. You know, people say, "Oh well, New York changes all the time." The city changes all the time. The boroughs have always been slow to change. If you go to Woodhaven, it still looks like the opening credit to All in the Family. It's still Archie Bunkerland. And so just, I wish people would respect that just a little bit. You know, Danny Hawk, great performer, had a one-man show at the Public Theater where he, you know, discussed gentrification. And he had this one beautiful skit that made me cry, where a Dominican guy goes into a bodega owned by a Spanish man and looks and sees, "Oh, you have soy milk now? My sister suffers. She's allergic to dairy. We've been asking you for 12 years to get soy milk. Now you get soy milk? We're not good enough?" That's what Spike is talking about. You know, now it's safer. Now the schools have improved. Now there's business plans and business initiatives. Why wasn't that then offered back then? It's just, I understand the pain. I understand the hurt. But it is what it is. And I think that we all need to come together and stop fighting and try to make it work so that everybody gets a piece of the new pie that's placed on the counter.
You moved to L.A. Were you thinking show business, or you also have talked about hoping to become a marine biologist? Did you think that would be more open to you, available to you in L.A.?
Yes, because I really wanted to go to San Diego State or San Francisco to be near the water. And it was warmer than New York, you know, but in regards to the entertainment world, no, that wasn't a thought in my head at all.
So how did you wind up on Soul Train? That was the beginning, wasn't it?
Yes. Me and my girlfriends, this girl Carol Diaz and Nia and Tracy, they would meet me after my science lab class. It was a nighttime class, and it was from 7 to 10.
You were going to community college?
I was going to community college, and that was organic biology. And they would honk the horn, and I would have my disco clothes and high heels in my knapsack, and I would ask to be excused, go to the bathroom, come back with my hair all hairsprayed and high heels. It was ridiculous. And we would go to Florentine Gardens, and a talent scout from Soul Train was there, and he saw me dancing, and he asked me to be on the show.
So how did you learn to dance? You didn't learn that at the home, did you?
No, I learned tap. And I learned a little bit of ballet. I wanted to be in synchronized swimming, but they said that my legs were too short. I just knew how to dance from birth. That's what my cousin Millie tells me, and my aunt, God rest her soul, told me. I just was always dancing.
You left Soul Train after you hit Don Cornelius in the head with a piece of chicken.
Yeah. That wasn't cool. That was an embarrassing moment for me.
But he had he was trying to take advantage of you economically?
Yeah.
So where were you going there? Were you still thinking marine biologist or were you
thinking... I was still going to college.
But then you became a choreographer for Bobby Brown.
Yes, and that was because a record company executive, Lowell Silas Jr., he's passed too, at MCA Records, saw me dancing hip-hop off camera. And he says, I want to hire you. I want you to teach that to this new solo artist. He's leaving his group, and his name is Bobby Brown. And I said, I'm not a choreographer. And he said, well, I'll pay you, I forgot the amount, I think it was $1,200. I said, I'll be there on Monday. And that's how I became a choreographer.
Was Bobby Brown already having the problems that later made headlines?
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to go there, you know. He's such a troubled soul. He's such a dent to can, you know. It's tough.
Well, you being a choreographer means that you have to work out routines for a number of people.
Yes.
So that was different than just going out there and improvising for yourself.
Yeah. Oh, yes. But, you know, another benefit of the group home was good and bad, but mostly I would say it was kind of good, but I still didn't want to be there, so I hated it, if that makes sense. But we, you know, were living in suburbia. That's why I loved it. And I got to be the manager of the cheerleading squad up there. And so I learned form and precision. And also the nuns, when they taught me how to tap dance. And so I knew routines and numbers. And all that came together when I started to choreograph.
Then how did you meet Spike Lee? That wasn't through dance, was it?
No. Yes, kind of. They had invited... some of the Soul Train dancers out to Funky Reggae for his, he was taking over the club and we got in an argument and he asked me to be in his movie. I said I wasn't an actress. He said, yes, you are. And he kept saying, tonight is fate. And I was like, oh, you wish. and then that's it.
Well, you have talked about Spike and some of your... the problems you had with Spike in the past. So, but there was a problem with nudity in the film. You'd signed a contract that specified you agreed to do a nude scene, but then you regretted it and wanted to change that?
Yeah, because I didn't understand what it would entail. I don't have a problem with my body, you know, but it was just, it wasn't tasteful and everything. But, you know, that said, I want to say something about Spike Lee. He changed my life. Yes, we had problems and they've all been resolved. And this book is about 20, 25 years ago. So all the issues in the book have been pretty much resolved. But I will be forever grateful to the man.
Well, it changed your life.
It
People suddenly
my
saw
life.
You as an actress.
Yes, yes. And in an iconic movie, in such a big way to have your first film. It's mind-blowing still when I think about it. And so I have an immense amount of gratitude and great respect for him.
What about the people back in New York, your mother, your aunt? How did they react to the film? Were they all proud of you? Were they...
I don't know how my mother reacted to the film, but my aunt was really, really proud. But my father, he literally went into cardiac arrest when he saw
because of the
nude
scene.
Because I was too afraid to tell him. I never told him. How are you going to tell your father that? Oh, Dad, by the way, I'm going to be in this movie and my breasts are going to be, you know, up on the big screen for all to see. You know, and so he... Oh, it was so horrible because he invited the entire town of Puerto Rico, of Aguadilla, to go see the movie. And then he goes into cardiac arrest. It was ridiculous.
But then you went back to choreography. I remember being confused because there your name was on the credits on In Living Color as the choreographer for The Fly Girls. Mm-hmm. But you were also in that movie.
Yes.
So you at that moment, were you being offered movie roles?
I was being offered movie roles, but I was also fighting for a lot of movie roles. The majority of the movie roles that was being offered were just negative stereotypes and just bad, bad movies.
You're going to be the tough ghetto chick?
Yeah, and so it just pissed me off. And, you know, so I said no a lot. I said no a lot. And the movies would still go with other actresses, and I would say to myself, how come they didn't, why did they do that? Like, I didn't understand. And, you know, but I had to fight for the roles that I got. And the way I fought for them was that with my representation, I had to make them understand, I will not accept these limitations. I want more out of life. And if this person, if this actress who is not of color is privy to him, so should I.
Well, you appeared in Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth. Yes. You were in White Men Can't Jump with Woody Harrelson. You had a major part there playing a rather difficult person. But
yes.
That was part of the charm. But they were not all fitting the stereotype.
No, they were.
And then there was Fearless.
And then there was Fearless. And they were all casted for white women. And I fought hard for them, and I'm glad I did.
You asked your father to be your date for the ceremony for the Oscar when you were nominated for an Oscar? What happened?
I'm not going to tell. Let the people read the book.
But you did mention that you have been in therapy. You were diagnosed as having PTSD because of that childhood?
Yes, yes. You know, my therapist told me such a great thing that I would like to share. She told me, you know, when you first came here, you were drowning in this sea of your past, and you were just treading water. And she said, and as our sessions have gone throughout the years, that sea has shrunk down to a river, to a lake, and now a tiny little pond. And it's always going to be there, that body of water, but it's about building a bridge over it so that you can get past it.
But you needed the therapy, the success, the fact that you were starring in movies, you were nominated for an Oscar. That wasn't enough?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, success to me was not that I was in movies and blockbusters and making a lot of money. Success to me was always having a wonderful home, love inside the home, wonderful support by friends and family. And so that wasn't gelling. And, you know, and so therefore I was totally frustrated with all this quote unquote success because I wasn't getting really what I needed. And so that's why I went to seek professional help.
But it also is obvious that you felt you had to give back. And that's why you've worked for arts programs for kids. Also became an AIDS activist.
Yes. 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 That was just a conviction in my heart, and I didn't understand it. I remember telling my girlfriend, I think I need to join the fight against AIDS. And she said, why? And I said, I don't know, but there's such a feeling in my heart, I have to do it.
Well, I'm afraid to reveal how that actually wound up becoming personal.
Don't. Yeah.
But the activism came before it actually touched you in another way.
Yes.
You will be in conversation with Hilton Alls and signing books at the Greenlight Bookstore tonight at 7:30. That's at 245 Clinton Avenue in Brooklyn. You're willing to go to Fort Greene to that's
Clinton
Hill.
Yes.
Yeah, well,
at St. Joseph College. That's where it's going to be. I'm very excited, and I hope people come out because I was talking to Melissa during the break. And
my producer.
Yes, your producer. And I was telling her, you know, everyone has secrets. And some secrets need to be revealed. And some need to be taken to the grave. But take your time to tell your story. Because quite honestly, it's nobody's business until you make it someone's business. And I have finally decided to reveal these secrets. And I just want to share, and I just want to connect with people.
Well, I suspect that some readers will say, oh, gee, I went through that, something similar, so I understand.
That's already happening. I'm getting stopped on the street because they have read the excerpt. You know, now it's out and released, but I'm getting it on Twitter. I have people telling me I was abused too, or I was in a home, or my mother or my father did this or that to me, and I had difficulty in my adult life as well. And it's mind-blowing to me, and I didn't expect this response, but I'm glad it's happening.
So there's the event tonight. at the Green Light Bookstore. And then you'll be speaking and signing books at the Strand Bookstore this coming Monday, March 3rd at 7 p.m. If listeners want more information about either of those events or anything else that's coming up, we have posted them on our show page at WNYC.org. Rosie Perez's book, her memoir, I almost said your latest book, but it's your only one, but there may be more, is Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair. It is published by Crown. And it's just one of the many things that Rosie Perez has done over her life. She's been a choreographer, dancer, a choreographer, an actress. She's been a talk show host on this show. And now the author of a memoir.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard, and thank you for being my friend. I appreciate it.